Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all to Trisha's True Crime Radio. I'm so glad you could join us tonight. We have a wonderful sponsor. I love this group. It's called Pause for Purple Hearts in Palo Alto, California. And Pause for Purple Hearts is the first program of its kind to offer therapeutic intervention for veterans and active duty military personnel by teaching those with post-traumatic stress disorder to train service dogs for their comrades with combat-related injuries. They could really use your help, though. So why don't you go to their website, www.pause, that's P as in puppy, A-W-S, for purplehearts.org. Okay, I hope everybody's ready, because we're getting right to it, and that is the legal goo. It's awfully sticky this time, so get ready. Here it comes. It's legal and it's gooey. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts. Do remember that, okay? Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from websleuths.com, LLC, and formsforjustice.org. In other words, my true crime darlings, if you get upset about something you hear on this radio show, you bring it to me. You don't take it out on the forums, okay? Okay, we have a great show lined up for you tonight. We have Dan Morris. Dan is a Washington Post reporter and author of the book, The Yoga Store Murder. We're going to talk to Dan about that book in a little bit. But Dan will be joining us as well as we talk about the latest school shooting, Sandy Hook, and all of that mess. Also joining us, I'm so delighted she's on our show tonight, is Jackie Schulkraut. She's a doctoral candidate at Texas State University in the School of Criminal Justice. And joining us is Jackie's research partner, H. Jamie Alsass. She is also a doctoral candidate at Texas State. And, of course, my co-host, Michael, in Minnesota, is here, and the wonderful people in our chat room. You all behave now. Hang on. We're going to get to our guests in just a minute. But first, it's so hard for me to even begin this. I get so emotional thinking about it because maybe, just maybe, if someone would have reached out to Adam Lanza just one more time, Sandy Hook would not be a household name. Now, that thought is from one of the Sandy Hook parents, and I agree with it. Everybody wants blood, and I get that. You know, you want to see punishment. It's all well and good to punishment. When we hear of a school shooting, our blood pressure rises. We want to get the guy. We want to kill him. And then when we hear that he's killed himself, we feel great about it. That's all normal, of course. But you know what? People, we're never going to solve this problem unless we find out why these kids and young adults think the way to solve their problem is to take a gun and go into a school and mow them down. It doesn't make any sense, and we need to ask why. Now, calm down, Nancy Grace out there. I'm not saying we need to, you know, coddle the bad guys. No. Sometimes they're not bad guys. Sometimes they're just really, really sick guys. And it really drives me crazy, and this is one of the reasons I can't watch Nancy Grace anymore, when somebody has the gall on her show to say, I wonder why this criminal did what he did. We need to look at his background. She practically reaches through the screen and takes their trachea out and ties it in a bow. She just rips them apart for daring to suggest that maybe there might be something that happened to them or something going on in their brain that maybe we can fix. Yes, we do need to punish. First and foremost, society needs to be protected from people who want to harm us. All right? If somebody is out there harming people, they need to be removed. End of story. But that doesn't mean we can't study and find out what happened to them. Let's go back to March 24th, 1998. Westside Middle School Massacre. Mitchell Johnson was 13. Andrew Golden was 11. They killed four students and one teacher. Remember, they pulled the fire alarm and they all ran outside and they were there. What in the name of God makes an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old think that's okay to do? There was talk in the very beginning that Mitchell Johnson was sexually abused, and come to find out, that's exactly it. And I think, especially in the younger kids, I'm guessing, my, you know, professional guess for what that is worth, which is probably nothing, but I think a lot of these younger kids are probably victims of sexual abuse, and they're very, very angry. Andrew Golden and Mitchell Johnson are both out now. Actually, I think Mitchell is back in prison for a gun charge, if I'm not mistaken. That isn't ironic, but, you know, they're out. They're out and about. What we need to find out why they did what they did, and that's one of the things that I want to try and accomplish here on Trisha's True Crime Radio, and that is go to the root of the crime and let's fix it. And my guests today, Dan Morse, Jackie Schulkraut, and Jamie Elsass. Welcome, everybody. I'm going to go to Jackie first. Jackie, tell us just a little bit about yourself, and when you're done, I'm going to ask you a question, okay?
Sure, that sounds great. I'm currently a doctoral candidate, as you mentioned, at Texas State University, and my research has focused primarily on the mediated aspects of school shootings and also rampage shootings, sort of how are we constructing this narrative in the public discourse about these events, because ultimately, you know, it comes down to when we're asking why, you know, where is this information coming from, how are we getting it, you know, is it accurate, and what can we take away from it, sort of thing.
Okay, so you're obviously incredibly smart. I mean, that's
That's there.
But I want to kind of back it up a little bit. So basically, you look at why the media reports the way it does and why it becomes almost a hysteria. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Yeah, definitely. You know, my research with Jamie, and she can jump in and add here as well, you know, what we focused on most recently is really looking at sort of this moral panic aspect of school shootings and rampage shootings. In reality, these events happen less than 10 times per year, but the amount of coverage the amount of coverage that they gather, you know, really makes them seem a lot more commonplace, and so we tend to have these very knee-jerk reactions to these events that are really quite rare, and instead of having really focused, well-researched policy, we tend to just jump in with the first thing that we think is the problem and try and put a Band-Aid on that when we're not addressing the bigger picture of what the issue may or may not be.
Can I have an amen, sister, for that? And Jackie, yes, that's Michael. I told you Michael was a brat. He is our co-host. He has to... Michael, you're here, I can tell. You're already being bratty. And it's only 2 minutes into the show. Are you okay?
Well, no. What it's 10 events is really not that common. I'm sorry. I have to.
Well, hold on, Michael. Michael, hold on. Hold on, please. Just hold on, okay? Calm down. Take a drink.
Okay.
Go get some vodka. Guzzle. I'll be right back with you, okay? Because I know what Jackie's saying. But, Jackie, here's the thing. Don't you feel that we do need to find out why these young adults and young kids feel it's okay to pick up a gun and go in and shoot people? And that is a problem that people don't want to talk about it. They just want them to be dead or locked up, right?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't think that anybody wishes any particular person to be dead. You know, ultimately, you know, we all want justice. How we define justice is obviously very different based on the person who's seeking that. You know, but I think I actually watched a special that Anderson Cooper had on CNN with the Sandy Hook about Sandy Hook. It had aired yesterday. And Daniel Barton's parents actually made a very poignant statement. It's not just about Sandy Hook. And, you know, Sandy Hook is a very pivotal event in this sort of ongoing disaster narrative that we have. We saw it sort of escalate with Columbine and stay in this forefront and this, you know, collective conscience. But it's not just about Sandy Hook. It's not just Adam Lanza. It's not just Mitchell Johnson and Andrew Golden. We have to look at the bigger picture.
And what is that?
What
is the bigger picture? What is that picture?
That is an excellent question. You know, we do live in a very in a society that condones a lot of violence. You know, and we see after these events that we immediately criminalize gun ownership. We immediately criminalize violent movies and violent video games. And you know, if you play Call of Duty or watch Natural Born Killers, you're the next mass shooter. And ultimately, I think we need to look a little deeper than sort of these surface explanations. You know, after Columbine, we thought that the problem was gun control, and so 800 pieces of legislation were introduced in the first year after Columbine. About 10% of those passed, and it hasn't stopped the problem. So I think what we need is a more robust sort of interdisciplinary look at what the different issues are, bring in people from political science, bring in people from law enforcement and criminal justice, bring in people from psychology and, you know, the social sciences, and have a collective effort in order to address the problem, because one person alone can't find that solution.
Jackie, we're going to go to your research partner, Jamie, in just a moment. Also, Dan Morris, a Washington Post reporter. But I know my co-host, Michael, here is chomping at the bit. Now, Michael, I think what in comparison to everything that goes on, to how many millions of kids go to school and how many hundreds of thousands of schools there are out there, 10 a year is 10 too many. But in the big picture, it's not a lot. Is that what you're saying, Jackie?
Well, and I don't minimize any amount of loss of life whatsoever. One person is one person too many. But if we contextualize this, number one, in how many kids go to school every year, there were studies conducted, and actually Jamie and I have cited this in our research, there were studies conducted that between 1992-93 school year and 97-98 school year, there was 50 million students enrolled in elementary, middle, and high schools in the United States. Now, during that time, there were 226 gun-related deaths on campus. So one's chance of being involved in a shooting on school's campus is less than 5 ten-thousandths. So essentially, you have a greater chance of walking outside on a clear and sunny day and being struck by lightning. We also have to contextualize it in the homicide rate here in the United States. We do see that homicide is a very rare occurrence, that we have about 14,000 incidents. And when we talk about it being a rare occurrence, that's in consideration of more common type events, property crime, auto theft, assault, things of that nature. You can look at the Uniform Crime Report. Homicide is very, very small percentage of the crimes that we see reported every single year, and an even smaller fraction of that are school-related school shootings.
Michael, are you there?
I
come
am.
Come on.
But now,
okay.
How long have these school shootings been going on? Since the beginning of time? It seems to me like it's a more recent sort
of
occurrence. Yes. But maybe.
In fact, Michael, I was just looking this up, and believe it or not, there was a school shooting that happened in 1764. And it goes from there. I mean, granted, it didn't get the media coverage, which I think is the big difference here. And I'm sorry, Jackie, I didn't mean to interrupt you and Michael, but go ahead.
Me or Michael?
Jackie, go ahead, and then Michael.
Oh, there were incidences in 1913, for instance, in Bremen, Germany. There was a student who shot his philosophy professor on the steps of the building that they held class in. Of course, with Jamie and I being in Texas, you know, we live right down the street from the University of Texas at Austin. There was a shooting there in 1966 that claimed 14 lives. But again, you know, these were extremely sporadic incidents compared to the coverage that we're seeing now. And so, you know, essentially, you know, research does show that there are less than 10 events per year, and, you know, of course, we'd all like them to be to zero, but I think it's important to underscore here that no matter what policies and procedures that we put into place, we are never going to reduce the risk to zero. There is an inherent chance, always, by the mere fact that we are all human beings. You know, there's always that sort of element of chance or probability, and so, you know, it's important to have focused and robust policies that make schools safer, places to go. There's certain things that we can do, even simple door locks, but we have to do it in a way that's well thought out, well researched, and well advised, and not, again, a knee-jerk reaction, you know, that is the result of this moral panic over school shootings.
Michael, you have the floor, my dear.
Well, so what I'm understanding, I mean, you, Jacqueline, you just cited a couple you know, incidents of school shootings, one in 1913 and then, of course, the 68 or whatever it was at the University in Austin, Texas. So it really has escalated recently to the 10 a year that it's become, right? I mean, before the 10 a year, wasn't it just every several years or several decades there would be an incident?
Well, when I say 10 a year, that's an average. We've seen years that there have been no shootings. We've seen years that there have been 10 shootings. I believe 2004 had no school shootings. And again, it's all going to come down to the definitional issue of how we define school shootings. I've sat through research presentations that have said suicides by gun at a bus stop is a school shooting, and that's not the case. You know, so we need to accurately define what these events are, how we, you know, classify them, and that kind of puts into context how much violence, school shooting related, there really is in schools. There was an incident in Orlando, Florida, actually, where I used to live and go to college the other day, and immediately everybody was on social media was going, oh, there's a school shooting in Orlando, there's a school shooting in Orlando. No, there was an incident of gang violence that happened to be taking place at a school. So a lot of, you know, how we define things and how we talk about things really boils down to how we understand and perceive them.
Does that help, Michael?
Sure, whatever.
Are you, Michael? See, I told you he's just a little bit bratty, but that's okay. That's why we love him. Let me go.
I don't mean to be bratty. I just
that's
think
okay.
that I don't remember ever hearing about it or thinking about it. And I certainly, you know, I wasn't the most popular kid in school, but I never saw anyone with a gun or heard of anyone with a gun in school. When I graduated in 1980, it was the most anyone ever brought to school was a pack of cigarettes in their sock, and they were considered badass. So,
well, that's
I
true.
Just
but
don't.
It has, let's face it, we hear about it a lot more because of the media, especially social media now. And Jackie, if I'm understanding you correctly, and I'm going to go to Jamie here and then Dan, so everybody hang on. Basically, and I'm going to try and put it in layperson's terms here and tell me if I'm incorrect. Basically, the media turns it into this big, huge event, which it is, but it turns into this something. I mean, you look at Chicago and the kids killing each other in Chicago, in the ghettos of Chicago. You know, every day kids are dying in the street, but we don't hear about that. But on this case, because of the way it's structured and what happens, it turns into a big media ordeal, and there are other ways to look at it. Jamie, before I get to Jackie, Jamie, I want to go to you. You've been sitting here so quietly. What would you like to add?
I'd like to add a couple of things. I think we see a very big difference in the amount of attention these events have garnered post-Columbine. Jackie can vouch and give the exact number of this, but there were a number of school shootings that occurred that had fewer fatalities in the years leading up to Columbine. And in the post-Columbine era, school shootings became very, very newsworthy. And at this point, anything that even on the surface and the beginning stages could be called a school shooting gets labeled a school shooting and thrown out into the media world, including social media. And as Jackie used the example from Orlando just recently, it can be seen that that we jump to that. The media, they jump to that label of school shooting before getting the facts. And I agree, a gang violence at a bus stop near a school is not the same thing when we're talking about Adam Lanza, when we're talking about our Columbine kids, when we're talking about Jonesboro. They're very different kinds of events. I also want to point out that Michael, I understand that you don't remember anyone bringing a gun to school because it very well may not have happened in your area, but with the, you know, the number, hundreds of thousands of schools that we have here in the United States, your one experience isn't necessarily generalizable to the nation as a whole and what's going on. So I think those are all really important things to take into account, and some recent research that I think helps in how we are perceiving this problem is the impact of social media. And Jackie and I can speak a little bit on that as we just finished working on a couple of projects that looked specifically at the impact of social media on our perception of these events and how the news media reports on these events.
And, Jamie, we will get to that here in just a moment, but I'd like to bring in Dan Morris, who's been waiting ever so patiently, the author of The Yoga Store Murder, which we'll be talking about in a little bit, and also Washington Post reporter. Dan, I just want to know your thoughts. What do you think?
Well, excuse me. Sorry about that. Well, certainly we in the media cover these shootings intensely, you know, and throw a lot at it when it happens. And but you know, I would point out that the, you know, since you know, if you wanted to define modern history over the last, you know, three or four decades, the two biggest mass shootings have been, you know, at schools, and one of them was big around here because it was at Virginia Tech, and mm-hmm. and the Washington Post, you know, we covered it in a huge way. That's 2007, and then Sandy Hook. And I think those numbers, you know, really alarm people. Just, you know, 2007, you have 32 people killed at Virginia Tech, and then 2012 in Sandy Hook, you know, there's 20 kids killed there. And, you know, I certainly agree with what the researchers are saying, that, you know, the coverage is intense and it's huge and it drives it. But, you know, those numbers also drive the story and drive, you know, why the media covers it so intensely.
Exactly, Dan. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Please
Trisha,
continue.
Can I add something there real quick?
Yes, and who is this? Who is talking now?
It's Jackie, sorry.
Okay, Jackie, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to add something to kind of contextualize it, and I agree with Dan, you know, and they have a job to do. You know, we're a very information-thirsty society, and we all sort of feel that we have this right to know, and Dan's job, as many other journalists across the nation, is to provide us with that information. But to put this into some sort of a context, Columbine lasted 46 minutes, and Virginia Tech lasted about 9. When he finally got into Norris Hall and started shooting, between the time that he started shooting and the time he finished shooting. The amount of coverage that these stories received far exceeded that. I believe in Sandy Hook, he may have been the shooting may have been active for somewhere 10 minutes or less, because that's usually about how long it lasts. To put it into perspective, the New York Times, in 30 days following the Sandy Hook shooting, had 130 stories. That's excluding blog posts, opinion posts, you know, op-eds, anything like that. That's 130 stories over an event that lasted less than 10 minutes. So it's a lot of coverage that's being generated, which makes it seem very disproportional.
But Jackie, don't you think that because, especially in Sandy Hook, we had 20 innocent kids killed, that it is so shocking and so horrendous that the coverage will continue because we can't believe it. We want to know more. And it is so appalling that we just can't have it one day and then forget about it. I mean, is that – I know you're not suggesting that, but what is it that you're suggesting? Is it a bad thing that it continues for 30 days because it was so horrific? Or are you saying it should be more proportionate? Where are you coming in on this?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is really interesting about what you just said is, and I absolutely do not think that we should not cover it, and what I've seen, and Jamie and I have talked about this quite a bit, is following Aurora, you know, sort of in the footsteps of what Governor Hickenlooper said, which is, we are not going to speak the name of the shooter, we are only going to remember the victims. And so we've seen a very interesting shift in how the media are covering these events, in that we're now starting to be more victim-centered instead of offender-centered. So we're mm-hmm. seeing more and more coverage of the victims and less coverage about the shooters. But what I think that's really important is about what you just said is, you said we, you know, and you said it a lot. And I think it speaks more to the society that we are and how we demand information and we buy into the sensationalization of something that, yes, is absolutely horrific, but we've seen other very horrific events happen recently that we don't place such a high value on. For instance, and it obviously isn't going to be as applicable to us, but on the same day of Sandy Hook, there was an incident in a school in China where the mm-hmm. exact same number of kids were knifed. And while we don't obviously follow Chinese media as closely, you know, it doesn't mean it's any less important in the greater discourse of violence in schools. We've had other incidences, you know, There was one on Friday. Of course, nobody's talking about it anymore. You know, we place different values. The more victims there are, the more we want to talk about it, the more we have to know. The younger those victims are, the greater, you know, value we place on their lives. Every single person that's been killed in violence in schools is just as important of a victim, if not another, you know, as anybody else. And I think that's what we have to recognize. But it does need to be more proportional. We need to report it in terms of facts. This is how many people were killed. This is the context. But also saying, this is how likely your chance of this happening to you is.
I see. So make it, report the facts, but dial down the hysteria a bit, and that's
absolutely
understandable. That's understandable. We're going to go around the table here in just a minute, but I want to reintroduce my guests so everybody knows who we're talking to. We have Dan Morris from the Washington Post and author of the book The Yoga Store Murder. We'll be talking about that in just a moment. And also joining us is Jackie Schulkraut, doctoral candidate at Texas State University in the School of Criminal Justice, along with her research partner, H. Jamie Elsass. We're talking about the media and the school shooting and how it's got to end somehow. And let's talk about social media for a moment. We've seen some pretty horrible things happen on social media. We've seen murders happen on social media. Social media is now ingrained in us. It will never go away unless something else bigger and better replaces it, and I don't see that happening in the next 100 years. Jamie, you mentioned that you did a lot of research on the social media as it compared to the school shootings. Tell us what you found out, what your research was about.
Sure. So Jackie mentioned earlier that that we've been studying the phenomenon of moral panic within the through the lens of school shootings, mm-hmm. and so we've conducted quite a bit of research in the past year and a half, looking at moral panics about school shootings. And one of the elements that we looked at was media effects, and we disaggregated those media effects to look at newspaper and television and radio, but also to look at social media. And what we found was that social media in today's world plays an extremely, extremely interesting role, especially when we're talking about these school shooting events. Not only does it directly impact the way these events are portrayed by the larger, more traditional media outlets such as newspaper and especially TV and radio, because you have people who essentially are live tweeting. If they use Twitter, they're live tweeting their experiences at these events. But we're also seeing just some very interesting lifespan of these kinds of stories, things that we haven't seen so much when we think about these kinds of events previously. And Jackie can jump in here at any time. She knows this research as well as I do. I think it's just been very interesting, particularly not only does social media seem to impact what we termed our general moral panic scale about school shootings, but it also impacts the particular attribute of disproportionality, which I think we've spent quite a bit of time talking about tonight. And it's that idea that these events occur more frequently than they actually do. And specifically, we actually disaggregated out different types of social media. So we looked at the effect of Facebook specifically, the effect of mm-hmm. Twitter. And we found that of the social media types we looked at, that Twitter in particular has a very strong positive effect on disproportionality.
Oh, go ahead. Please continue.
Our theory of why this is going on, right? How we're backing up why this is occurring, our idea about why this is occurring, is that it has to do with the way Twitter functions. I mean, it's mm-hmm. very much looks like an RSS newsfeed, and people use it for that. And the ability to tweet and then retweet allows things to be thrown out there at just exponential levels. It reaches, I mean, so many more followers than the original target audience. And to to go along with that, we have major news corporations like Fox, CNN, MSNBC, who are specifically turning to Twitter and sending their news viewers to Twitter. For example, during the recent LAX shooting, watching Fox News, they actually had a group of people set up on computers in the newsroom, and they would cut to them as they monitored the Twitter feed. And mm-hmm. they would refer people to LAX's Twitter feed if they wanted to get news faster at the scene than Fox News itself was going to be able to relay. And that's a very interesting shift in news.
Well, it's making the people on the scene their own personal reporters, which I don't think is a bad thing. I mean, let's face it, people right there that are reporting it, we get the facts from them. Granted, they may be a little bit skewed, but I don't see that as a bad thing. But what I'm hearing from you is that it's the total effect of all this media making something really big, but I just think it's human nature because it is so horrific, and that's why it's big, and that's why we hang on to it. And again, what that might do, and I don't know, but does it give ideas to other people who are unbalanced, who want to come in and make a statement? I don't know. I liked the idea of not saying the name of the person who was the shooter and just focus
Absolutely.
On the victims. That's the best way, I think, to handle it, because then you can kind of de-emphasize the person who was doing the shooting. But it all goes down to mental illness and that's the fact of everything as far as these types of shootings. These people are mentally ill, and we need to step in first and get them help and not be criticized because we want to help them rather than let them continue to spiral down until they pick up a gun and go shoot somebody. Dan Morris, again, very, very quiet. I have a feeling, though, I can feel those brain waves. They're just bubbling with thought. Go ahead.
No, it's very interesting. Just sitting back and listening, and you know, it is true that we cover these school shootings with such such power and such velocity or whatever that since 1980 the total number of murders, the murder rate in the country has basically been cut in half. I mean, there were the chances of getting shot and murdered in this country, it's a lot safer than it was. 1980, I think we peaked at a murder rate of, you guys can jump in, but I think it was maybe 10 per 100,000, and that's been cut in half. So, you do, when you see all this coverage of all these schools, it does create this idea that we're not safe, that our kids any moment can go off to a school and become dead. And it does, I think it's important for us in the media to remind people of things like, actually the murder rate is a lot less than it used to be. And even in the context of crime, in the context of how kids get shot, you still, last year a lot more kids, unfortunately, were the victims of gun violence outside of Sandy Hook. I mean, just the same horrible shootings are going on. And, we did have a story like that over the last few days where we actually tracked, all the other kids who were shot, mm-hmm. in domestic violence and in gang fights where there were stray bullets, and some really smart reporters at the paper went through and did all that just to kind of remind people that there's a lot of other stuff going on that mm-hmm. everything needs to be sort of brought back into context.
That makes perfect sense. Michael, are you still there?
Hello, yes, I'm here.
Do you have any questions or any comments before I continue on? I want to make sure.
Well, as far as the media, this is nothing new. They glom onto a story and repeat it ad nauseum. I mean, you can look at any major death or case, Anna Nicole Smith, I was so sick about hearing about her for days and days. There was that incident of road rage that happened with that family, and CNN talked about that for days and days and days, and I'm completely understanding what the ladies are saying. Once something has happened, report it, move on. I mean, they don't need to keep talking about it day after day after day. It bores the shit out of me, but that's all I'll say.
And we can and we can say that on Trisha's True Crime Radio because we're adults, we can swear, but you know, only on special occasions. Jackie, we're running out of time here. I would kind of like you to wrap things up, and then I'll have Jamie have a last word, and we'll go from there. Okay.
Okay.
Tell us, just kind of wrap up what you're doing and what you think and where we're going.
Well, what I'm doing is, you know, really trying to bring to light, and Jamie's extremely instrumental. We work very well together on this. You know, we're trying to really contextualize this problem and to bring it into, to keep it in the light that it deserves to be in, but to do so in a respectful, well-researched manner. And, you know, just to throw this in there, because I know that you mentioned that you wanted to talk about mental health, I think we need to have a serious talk about that at a very national level, but also at a very, you know, informal individual level. Because, you know, after Virginia Tech happened in 2007, President Bush passed the NICS Amendments Improvement Act, which allocated about $1.3 billion in federal funding to improve mental health reporting so that people that should be disqualified from getting background checks would be disqualified. And only about $50 million of that within the first 5 years was appropriated. Now, we've seen a tremendous shift in the last year as a result of Sandy Hook, where now 37 states have passed legislation in order to improve reporting, to improve services, which is fantastic, but it doesn't need to be done at the expense of criminalizing a nonviolent mental illness. Research has shown that people with Asperger's disease are not violent, about 2% of cases, and they're even less violent outside of their own family. So I think that we're really criminalizing the wrong people, and when we have this national discussion of why and we talk about what's important, we need to put everything into context and have all of the facts and not the hysteria and the hype, and that's really kind of where I'd like to leave it.
And Jamie, final, we'll leave you with the final word.
Okay, I think Jackie hit the nail on the head there, and of course I may be a little biased about her opinion as we do work together so well, but I think it's very important that we have a serious, realistic talk about mental health in this country and a serious, realistic talk about guns in this country. I think when one of these events happen, we jump to, like Jackie mentioned, we have a knee-jerk reaction, and that leads to some feel-good legislation. And then we all pretend that whatever feel-good legislation went through fixed the problem. But most often, overwhelmingly, that legislation isn't created on the basis of strong research. And that's a problem in itself. That exacerbates and continues the issues we're having because people never really get help. And we never really get a strong mental health system started. And we never really get some good gun legislation, some responsible gun legislation in because we jump to a knee-jerk reaction, we placate it with feel-good legislation, and we wipe our hands and move on until the next shocking event happens. And that's the real issue.
And Jamie, you are ever so right. I'll say it again. Amen, sisters. Thank you so much to Jackie Schulkraut, doctoral candidate at Texas State University in the School of Criminal Justice, and her amazing research partner, H. Jamie Elsass. Ladies, thank you. It was very informative. We'll have you on again very, very soon. You guys take care now, okay?
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, there we go. And Dan, you are still with us, correct?
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay. Well, you missed all the excitement in the chat room. We had I would call it a wad of jerks come in all at once. It was like a big wave. It was like a tsunami of jerks just flew in, and they're gone now. So that's why if things were a little choppy, that's why. But we've got them kicked out now. And now we're going to move on to a book, and this book is fascinating. It's called The Yoga Store Murder. And it's written by a man. We've heard a little bit from him today so far. His name is Dan Morse. And I really like what you have on your bio page. When people go to the yogastoremurder.com website, it says you graduated with an engineering degree and a writing degree. And so after graduation, Morse combined his engineering degree and writing, and as if it had been well planned, took a position at Civil Engineering Magazine in New York. Who among us can forget his wonderful article, Sludge in the 90s? I thought that was hilarious. So you're a civil engineer and a writer, and you actually got a job at Civil Engineering Magazine. That just sounds like a sitcom waiting to happen. I mean, I love that. So how did you leave? How did you pull yourself away from Civil Engineering Magazine, and how did you end up at the Washington Post, Dan Morse?
Yeah, how did I pull myself away from sludge articles, I guess is what,
yes,
what
exactly.
Well, I guess it comes back to how I got the job. You know, I graduated with this engineering degree, but had started writing for the school newspaper and liked journalism. And so the job at Civil Engineering was sort of, it was kind of the only job I could get, and I got it, you know, by virtue of my engineering degree. And I really liked the journalism part of it. And after a couple of years of doing that, I realized, you know, I needed to learn a lot about journalism. And also, you know, I wanted to cover other stuff, you know, besides mm-hmm. engineering. I wanted to cover crime and, you know, all the stuff that reporters get to do, you know, government and business. And so I wrote to a lot of newspapers and got an offer from exactly one of them down in Alabama, and that's where I started. Started at a little afternoon paper in Montgomery. Started covering crime, and immediately found it to be a fascinating subject. And you know, since then I've covered other stuff in my career and sort of have come back to crime mm-hmm. over the last 6 or 7 years. And then, you know, from Alabama, I could take you through all the steps, but there were just a number of papers along the way. Spent a lot of time in the South and then came to the Post about 7 years ago.
And so you've been there for 7 years. Have you been exclusively their crime writer, or what have you done?
Well, when I came here, I was like a general assignment guy. I've always been on the local staff here, wrote about just kind of interesting, cool stuff in the area. I wrote a story about how if you run a junkyard these days, how different your business is with the internet, you know, just stuff like that, mm-hmm. Interesting features about people. And then an opening came out. We have different crime reporters in different jurisdictions, and there was an opening in a county just north of Washington, Montgomery County, of about 1 million people to cover both crime and courts there. And so I moved into that slot about 4 years ago. And it's a really interesting place to cover crime. And, you know, it's a great newspaper to do it for as well.
Well, absolutely. I'm telling you, that is the cream of the crop, as they say. Well, let's get into this book, The Yoga Store Murder. Here you are, a writer, and you're a reporter. Granted, it's true crime, but there are millions of true crime stories out there. How did you get into the yoga store murder?
Right. So this is a case that I covered for the Post. You know, it happened in the county that I covered. The crime was discovered on Saturday morning. I remember very clearly. I was leaving our place. I was actually, you know, doing something responsible, going on my way to the dry mm-hmm. cleaner, and got a call from a cop that said, you know, there's been a really, really, really bad murder. And, you know, it was a source who was kind of looking out for me because this was a Saturday. It was my day off. And he was basically saying, you know, you need to get down there because this is going to be a big deal. And that's kind of all mm-hmm. he told me. And so I go down to the scene. It's about 2 miles from where I live, and right away, it was clear there were going to be some unusual things about this murder, and there were a lot of unusual things that I just learned just, you know, that first day covering it. You know, I've certainly been asked a lot, like, why this? You know, why write a book about this crime? And, you know, I would say, you know, one thing with just the stunning nature of the violence, I mean, just leave everything else aside, you know, mm-hmm. The poor victim in this case, really nice woman, 30-year-old woman, is hit and stabbed and cut, you know, 330 times. You just don't, that just doesn't really happen very often.
That's really,
you know,
personal. That's really personal.
Right. So just, you know, that alone is, gets you start to think, well, this could be, you know, unique or whatever, or unusual enough to certainly explore as a book.
Okay, Dan, let's do this. Let's give us kind of the outline of this murder, why it's so fascinating, and then we'll jump in from there, okay?
Sure. If, you know, and if I can sort of set the scene for, you know,
please do.
A lot of people who don't live in the Washington area, where this happens is an area called Bethesda, which is just outside of Washington. It's a really nice place. It's, you know, by some measurements, it's like the most educated place in the country. I mean, it's just half the people are walking around with master's degrees, and it's also very wealthy, and they've got this little central area with very nice shops and very nice restaurants. People gather there, they walk around. It's just about as nice as it could be, you know, and it's not a violent place at all. And that's where I go on that Saturday morning, right? So I mm-hmm. go down there. I'm in downtown Bethesda, and already, you know, they got the crime scene roped off on this store that, you know, I'd walked by it because I'd been down mm-hmm. there, you know, a bunch, and never really noticed it. It's got a funky name to it. And unless you're into this place, you don't really know about it. The store is called Lululemon Athletica. It's got a weird name.
That is, you know, a weird name.
You know, one thing I learned as a detective, you know, I spent the first few days trying to figure out how to pronounce this place.
That's why I'm calling it the Yoga Store Murder. It's just easier, much easier.
So that's where it happened, you know, and so I'm outside the store. Of course, you know, I'm a reporter, right? It's not like they invite me in and say, Dan, you know, come take a look at this. So I'm outside the store, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, what is this store, you know? And there's other reporters helping me out, and we're figuring out that, well, you know, they sell yoga stuff, and they sell, like, yoga pants for, like, $100. You know, one of the cops on the scene just said, you know, it is, I just remember him telling me this. He's like, it's like a horror movie inside there. Mm-hmm. You know, that, and I'm sitting there going, well, this is like a yoga store. You know, this is.
They do yoga stuff.
Yeah, it's supposed to be this, like, peaceful Zen place. So, so that's you know, that's the where it happened. It was certainly unusual, just because it's such a nice place. And I think that certainly played a role in the coverage. It played a role in, you know, one of the interesting elements about no one called 911. And, you know, the place where this happened certainly mm-hmm. drove a lot of the story as well, I think.
And let's talk a little bit about the 911 call. There were people there, I think it was at the Apple store, that heard the screaming, and they just didn't do anything. What was that about?
Right. So that's how the book starts. Like, what mm-hmm. I've been talking about is on a Saturday morning. That's when the bodies, you know, that's when the body is found. That's when the police start their work. But the story begins the night before, and it actually begins inside an Apple store, which is, again, in this really nice area, really high-end stores. And the people in the Apple store are trying to close up. You know, everything's shut down. They just had a big day of sales because they just rolled out one of their new gizmos, not just the iPad, but the iPad 2. You know, so they had a big day of sales, and they heard screams next door, and they heard some crashing sounds, and, you know, and they tried to figure out what to do. I mean, at first they didn't really know where the screens were coming from. They thought maybe they were like upstairs in their own store. So, you know, one of the managers and the security guard, they're looking all over the store, like wondering if something had happened in their store, you know. Maybe maybe someone was inside their store creating trouble. And they didn't see any trouble in their store. But, you know, they can still hear these screams next door. And one of them, you know, we sort of got this, you know, I was able to get this in the book, sort of a, you know, a moment-by-moment account of what they're going through because, you know, they talked to the detectives about this, and I got their statements of what they talked about in there, and there was internal video. And, you know, one of the managers said to the other manager, well, like, you know, maybe I should just call the cops. And she was kind of... You know, she didn't get a positive reaction from the other guys who thought they didn't think they were listening to a murder. I mean, obviously, if they did, they would have called.
Sure.
And they certainly should have. But, you know, I think the safe place that I'm talking about played a role. And, you know, what
because
one of the guys...
It just didn't happen there. Those type of things didn't happen. You heard a scream, you don't worry about it. It's just something else.
Right. In fact, one of the managers had a specific reaction that he told the detectives about. He said, yeah, you know, that scream, it sounded like the anguish of someone just getting bad news over the phone. And that's, you know, that's how he got it into his brain. And so, you know, clearly they should have called. And what's tragic is they almost did, you know, and they even talked about it.
She could have survived. The victim could have survived if they called. That's what's so sad.
Well, you know, there is, you're right. I mean, no one will ever know, but this murder, this attack took place for at least 10 minutes. And, you know, this is a pretty well-patrolled area. And, you know, when the police were finally called the next morning, they got there within 2 or 3 minutes. So, you know, they would have been there very quickly. That's something everyone has to live with, you know, obviously. Mm-hmm. The victim's family has to live with knowing that, you know, and the people in the Apple store have to live with that as well.
Let's talk a little bit. We're going to jump around here. The book is called The Yoga Store Murder. We do have a question from the chat room. This comes from Sleuth. Does the book contain psych profiles of the murderer? Now, the murderer is no secret in this book. These two girls were friends, and they worked at this store, and one of them killed the other one, and it is just a horrific. You need to read the story to see how the police finally came around to this, because everyone thought she was the victim too. They thought that Brittany Norwood was a victim, and she wasn't, but she made herself look like a victim. What can you tell us about Brittany from the book? Why? I mean, she came from a nice family, wonderful girl. What happened? How did she snap?
Yeah, well, you know, the book tries to get at that, and, you know, I think in two ways. One, you know, I just try to describe how she grew up and what her life was like right up until this night. And she did not talk to me, which, you know, I certainly didn't hold against her. She's in prison, and she's got an appeal going, and she's, you know, just wasn't in her interest to do any of that, to talk to me. But I was able to get text messages that she had, you know, written and received over a 3-year period, which I thought was really, you know, good for me.
Yeah.
And it really, you know, she was someone who texted a lot, and so, you know, you read these things and you get a good insight into not only what someone is saying but what they're doing. And, you know, on a surface and to the people she knew, you know, her close friends and her family, she was kind of cool, you know. She was fun, she was smart, she was athletic. She has got these two little nephews that like adore her, and, you know, she's real likable. You know, to take it all the way up to the day of the murder, she wakes up and she goes to yoga class. I mean, that's how she begins her day. And it's sort of this athletic yoga. It's like an aerial yoga where you're hanging from these slings. And, you know, then she goes out to lunch with a friend, and then she goes and gets her nails done, and then she works at this yoga shop. And, and she's talking to customers, and she's smiling, and she's happy, and then this, you know, this sort of madness happens, you know, everyone has struggled to figure out why, and, you know,
Let me just ask you something. Was there,
sure.
When you talked about her text, when you talked about Brittany's texts, was there anything in there that seemed weird? What was off about her? What thing kind of made you go, wait a minute, this is just not right about this young woman?
Right. Well, yeah, there was, you know, just to go back just real quick on that thread about her being cool. I mean, there was a lot of that in her text messages, you know. It's like you'd read them and you're like, okay, I can see why there's a bunch of smart people who are friends with her. She seems cool and funny and all that. Well, you know, one thing she would do that you know, I'd be reading and I'd go, whoa, is she would come up with these sort of outrageous lies. You know, if she had to drop an appointment with a hairstylist, she would say she was out of town. She would say that, you know, she was visiting a sick relative when she, in fact, was in town, you know, and it was, you know, it was sort of an ability to come up with a really big lie that didn't need to be told, you know, and that sort of was unusual. I didn't see anything in the text that made me think this person was violent or capable of violence, you know.
Well, yeah, people do make up stories when they don't have to. There are people that lie when they don't have to. It's just that the act itself was so violent and so horrific. There were different instruments used. I mean, it was the anger that came out and killed this poor woman that they were working the same shift together. It was Jana Murray, and, I mean, by all accounts, they never had a problem. And this vicious animal came out of Brittany for some reason, and it's very frightening, and it's a compelling read because you're reading about these two wonderful young women, and one of them turns into this vicious killer. Michael in Minnesota, you've been very quiet. I want to make sure that you're still there.
I'm absolutely here, and I'm loving this. First of all, a couple things. For some reason, this murder with 330-plus wounds didn't really garner national attention. And I'm surprised by that, because I would have certainly heard about it in Minnesota, I think. So anyway, I thought that was odd. But in your coverage of this, David, did you ever believe Brittany, or did you suspect that Brittany was not a victim as well? Or did you think,
No, I didn't. You know, I was sort of floored by it. And you know, the detectives were really keeping this close to their vests. You know, so that first morning, the statement from the police, you know, from the public affairs office of the police is, look, we got two victims here. You know, one of them's dead, and the other is talking to us from the hospital bed, and she's been sexually assaulted, and she says that there were these two crazy men who came in wearing masks and just went crazy and, you know, and killed Jana and raped them both. And, I mean, the police, you know, took Brittany's version of the events, which, I mean, there's a whole cover-up that Brittany engaged in that's fascinating and bizarre, and but you know, that was their public statement from the beginning. Now what's going on behind the scenes is the detectives are kind of you know, after a few days, are starting to wonder about Brittany's story, and then they're starting to change their investigation, and it you know, a whole week goes by where us and the media think that they're looking for the crazy men, and then they announce that, well, actually the victim is someone who we are going to charge with murder. And it, you know, it surprised me. I did start to get some calls, you know, a day or two before, saying, you know, they're looking at the victim. But I mean, that was a pretty dicey story, and no one really wanted that.
Well, no
story
one saw it coming. Yeah.
Yeah,
nobody saw it coming, and she and Brittany was is such a appears to be such a sweet, normal young lady that that's the last thing, like you said, you want to hear. But Michael, I know you found this story very compelling, and Dan, why do you think there wasn't any huge national media? Because I don't remember this story.
You know, I'm not sure. I think, well, it wasn't at a school.
Yeah, there wasn't a school
to what
shooting.
We were talking about before. You know, I don't know. It it was certainly a very fascinating case. You know, in some ways, maybe I don't have a very good perspective on that because locally, you know, it was huge.
It was huge
around here. And I think what happened around here was, you know, people were engaged from the beginning because it was like everyone's nightmare crime. You know, it was the random crazy guys in masks who not only would, you know, kill someone randomly, but they would rape these women. And, you know, it was like, it's the kind of crime that really doesn't happen very often, but it's what everyone fears.
And
suddenly there
crime,
it was. So everyone was engaged in it. And then when it took this U-turn, people were even more fascinated because, you know, you really are, you know, it's just human nature to want to know, like, well, you know, as horrific as this crime is, now you're telling me that the sweet victim is actually a killer, you know, who could do this type of killing.
Horrible thing.
And so then people became very engaged in, well, what's she about? You know, how could she have done this? So.
Was there any race issue? Because Jana Murray was white and Brittany Norwood was black. Was there a race issue at all?
I certainly never found one, you know, and people were sort of wondering about that. And, you know, it gets back to, you know, one central truth here, which is I think that there really wasn't a whole lot personal between Jana and Brittany to begin with. You know, they only knew each other for about 5 weeks. Brittany was kind of new to that store. So there wasn't, you know, there wasn't animosity. There wasn't that kind of sort of, you know, personal trouble between these two. And also, you know, one of Brittany's best friends in high school was white. Brittany went to a high school that did not have a lot of African Americans. And, you know, people just told me she got along fine with, you know, that race wasn't really a factor with her. And certainly a lot of her friends in Washington in this area, you know, were also white. So I just didn't pick that up from, you know, that was any kind of motive on Brittany's part.
Brittany Norwood, the victim who actually ended up being the perpetrator in the book The Yoga Store Murder, we're talking with Dan Morris. What was her family like? I know her father was just obviously torn up by all of this. What? Tell us a little bit about her family life.
You know, everything I could find was very good. I mean, she grew up with eight brothers and sisters in suburban Seattle. You know, this is a crowd that has done pretty well for themselves. She's got three brothers who are engineers. She's got a sister who's a doctor. She's got another sister who's pretty, you know, pretty good in sort of business consulting stuff. And this is a generation of Norwood kids that have gone to college and that have really done well. And none of them grew up with very much. You know, her dad worked at an upholstery shop, you know, just scratched out a living, and they, you know, they just did not have a whole lot. They you know, consistently excelled on the soccer field. That helped a lot of them, you know, with college, I think. It certainly helped Brittany. She got an athletic scholarship to play soccer. So she came from a real nice family, and, you know, that factors into then, you know, this big question of why she did it. You know, you sort of wonder where someone came from. And, you know, everyone who came in contact with the Norwoods was impressed by them, you know. And I think of two of the detectives I write about a lot in the case who, you know, you think about guys, these detectives, you think about them getting emotionally attached to the victims' families, right? I mean,
right.
Certainly they did that in this case for good reason. You know, Jana comes from a wonderful family, but, you know, these two guys also got to know Brittany's family in the course of this investigation, and they didn't like, you know, they had no problem putting Brittany away, but they didn't
mm-hmm.
like, you know, what her family was going through. And
that was
what,
awful.
Yeah. So.
Now, what was, and I don't want to give away too much of the book here, but what was Brittany's defense? I mean, did she try and deny that she did it, or what was the story?
Well, so from the beginning, she said that, you know, that they were attacked by these guys, you know, and that's,
mm-hmm.
that was what she stuck, that was the story she stuck with the detectives. And, you know, they tried to get her, once they thought she was lying, they tried to get her to come off that story, and she never really did. They could never break her. They sort of threw every trick they had at her. And then, so, you know, the trial happens, and she sort of got three strategies she could do, and, you know, I try to explore all three of these. One is, you know, she could have stuck with that story
mm-hmm.
and gone to trial and just said, well, okay, prove it. You know, prove that what I'm saying didn't happen. Or she could have gone an insanity route, which, you know, when you think 330 injuries, you think, well, okay, maybe that's the route.
She's nuts. Right.
Yeah, that she's insane. Or you could say, you know, which is a pretty common defense in murders, which is, I did it, but it was actually a form of self-defense, or it was a
mm-hmm.
mutual fight, and, you know, it wasn't premeditated. And, you know, in Maryland, where this trial happened, that's a big deal because, you know, if you're convicted of that, you can get out of prison within about 15 years, which is, you know, a lot better
Pretty
deal
good.
Than spending the rest
yeah.
of your life there. So you know, that's
well, Michael in Minnesota, our wonderful co-host, does have a question. Michael, what is your question?
Yeah, from whom did the story come from about the yoga pants that Brittany supposedly was trying to steal that were in her purse? Somewhere I read where it was the store's policy that each employee had to check the other's purse to ensure that there was no theft or
right.
stealing from the establishment, and Jana discovered this pair of pants in Brittany's purse, and Brittany tried to claim that she had got them from one of the other coworkers, and Jana called to verify that, and the coworker denied it or said it's not true, and so she confronted her about it, and that's what led to this heinous crime. I mean, the worst that could have happened to Brittany would have been losing her job for theft. Why? How does a person make a leap from, first of all, where did that story come from? Is it accurate? But, and then what goes through a person's mind that going to prison for life for brutally murdering someone is better than losing a job, or is an alternative to losing a job? I just can't quite understand it.
Yeah, no, it's real hard to get your brain around that final point you make. Now, what you said about what transpired is good. It's accurate. Now, you know, one of the interesting things is that did not come out in the trial just because of some rules about evidence. But, you know, I was able to put together that narrative of what happened because the investigators were able to piece all that together. And so what happened...
She stuck to her story, where did that story finally come from, do you know?
Brittany did stick with it. So what happened was there was this bag check that you talk about, and then both Brittany and Jana left the store. It was complicated, and it took the detectives a little bit time to figure out what happened. But So what happens is they leave the store. You know, well, they shut the store down at about 9. It's just those two in the store. They're doing all their clothing stuff. And then, you know, one of the last things they do is look in each other's bags, which is, you know, which is actually fairly common in retail. You know, employees do that so that no one steals. Lululemon is kind of the zen, peaceful management deal, and so everyone looks at everyone's bags. You know, there's no managerial hierarchy thing. So they looked in each other's bags, and Jaina finds these yoga pants that still have a tag on them, and she asks Brittany. She's like, "Well, what's up with this?" And Brittany tries to say that, well, I bought them from another coworker, and then Jaina doesn't buy the story, but they go and they leave peacefully, and then about 5 minutes later, you know, as they've gone their separate ways, Brittany calls Jaina and says, I think I left my wallet at the store. Can you come back and meet me at the store?" Jaina had a key to the store and Brittany didn't. So all that interplay right there, the detectives were able to learn because after Jaina left the store, she made a couple of phone calls to her coworkers and explained what happened. And then also you can tell that she had tried to get into the computer system basically to verify Brittany's story. So you know that, you know, Jaina didn't buy that story. That's just a known deal. And then they left and they came back to the store, and that's when all this stuff happened. That's where you get into the debate of, you know, was it premeditated or not? What did Brittany have in mind? Why did she bring Jaina back to the store? And what happened from there?
That sounds like premeditation to me. Michael, go ahead, please. You had some more comments?
Well, absolutely. And somewhere I read when it only took the jurors 1 hour to decide on first degree, because as one of the jurors pointed out, there's no other way to look at it. 331 wounds, even if you started out as a manslaughter in the first wound, it turns into premeditated murder when you are going to ensure that person does not recover, which 331 wounds would do. I saw a picture or a post of the supposed weapons used, and the only ones I could understand were a hammer and like a slide rule, but some of the things that they were calling weapons, I couldn't figure out what she could have possibly even done with them to be lethal. And
right.
So, and I didn't read anywhere about her faking a sexual assault on her, so I'm assuming she did some self-mutilation in the genitalia area or something. But I thought I read where she only inflicted a couple really inconsequential wounds on herself with what made the police so suspect of her story.
Oh yeah, you're absolutely right. She, you know, so the wounds to herself were almost, you know, there's debate at the trial of whether to call them a cut or a laceration or a scratch. I mean, they were really just right along the surface. I think as far as the premeditation, and that's, you know, a bit of an open question. I think, you know, as you try to reconstruct what happened in that store, I don't think that Brittany was, you know, so they go their separate ways, and then Brittany brings her, you know, calls her back to the store. I don't think at that point Brittany wanted to kill her. I think she wanted to talk her out of this shoplifting deal. You know, don't tell the manager, you know. Some version of don't tell the manager, I'm going to quit, please, you know, just let it go. And the problem that Brittany had is, and you know this from Jaina's phone records, is that she had already called the manager. And then you know from what the manager told the detectives from that conversation that they had talked about this. So I think Brittany wanted to talk herself out of trouble, and she had successfully done that in the past. You know, when she had gotten jammed up in the past, she'd always been able to talk her way out of stuff. And that didn't go very well. When, you know, it only took a matter of minutes when they got back to the store, you know, before all this stuff started. And, you know, I think, you know, in the law of premeditation is it can happen pretty quickly. You know, you don't need to, you don't need to plot this for a day. You only need to plot it for a few seconds. And so, you know, I think, yeah, and there were a few more things about, you know, it wasn't just that she was going to lose this job. She had another really cool job interview at a different place lined up for the next week, so it would have cost her that. So, I mean, still, you know, unbelievable.
You know, yeah. Violence for that. We're talking with Dan Morris. Dan is the author of The Yoga Store Murder, fascinating book, and we have a question from the chat room. How many wounds to the perp and the perpetrator that is Brittany Norwood? How many wounds did Brittany have as opposed to Jaina, who had 330? How many did Brittany have?
You know, Brittany maybe had, maybe about 10. And really only two of those are at all significant. You know, there's a cut to her forehead that needed, you know, one or two stitches, and there's some cuts to her hand that needed some stitches. And then the rest are these superficial scratches. And, I mean, it was incredibly disproportionate. And that was a big, you know, telling point for the detectives that something might be a little off here.
Did they suspect very quickly early on that there was something off because of the lack of injuries to Brittany? They must have. Like, that night, they must have been thinking, wait a minute, this is just weird. Or have they ever said?
Oh, they did. You know, they did. And they were good about telling me all that stuff. You know, and I tried to recount how they went back and forth on that score. And, you know, there's two lead detectives, but there's probably a total of, you know, five or six of them working on it that day inside the store. And, you know, they kind of go back and forth, and a lot of this, they're really trying to be sensitive because they've got a potential surviving rape victim here. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting things that go back and forth. You know, what happens is one detective goes down to the hospital and talks to Brittany, you know, on a hospital bed.
Mm-hmm.
And she comes back to the store and tells the guys, you know, hey, look, she seems really credible, and what she told me was just terrible. And it's just, you know, she's been through a lot. And you know, it is a horrendous story. And so these guys, you know, and then they start looking through the whole crime scene, and, you know, it just, there's stuff that right away didn't quite make sense to them. And then they got some photographs of Brittany's injuries from the hospital, and that didn't really make sense to them. But you know, then it was sort of swinging back and forth. You know, another thing they kept in mind was, all right, you know, her story maybe isn't making sense, but let's say that what she's saying is true. You know, let's say that these guys came in, they raped both Jaina and Brittany, and then, you know, they massacred Jaina. You know, that means Brittany was a witness to all this horrible trauma. So of course, her story's not going to make sense because...
So traumatized.
You know, of what she's been through. So that weighed in. And then there was this videotape that sort of drove the case as well. You know, it's just all these little things are flying, you know, in different directions as these guys are trying to sort through. And one of them is that they see this surveillance stuff, the surveillance image from behind the store, which, you know, shows two guys dressed head to toe in black clothing, you know, walking right by the back of the yoga store at the time that they would have been exiting the store. And they were like, oh my goodness, you know.
Oh, wow.
That's the guys, you know. And
right.
you know, even the most cynical of them was like, you know, I guess my effing theory is out the window when he saw that video. And, he, you know, here was the other, the big shocker for them was, you know, they thought when they didn't, when they doubted Britney's story, you know, the only, what that caused them to do was think that maybe Britney somehow knew these guys, you know, that she had set up a robbery that went bad. You know, it was never, there was never any thought from the beginning that she did this. You know, it was always, you know, the guys who doubted it and they were kind of back and forth just thought that maybe she knew these guys, you know.
And that was it.
And that was
right.
It. And,
Michael, you have a question. Michael, my wonderful co-host in Minnesota, what is your question for Dan Morse, author of the book The Yoga Store Murder?
Oh, I apologize. I think I called you David earlier. Dan,
oh, that's
have
funny.
You
funny.
You said that Britney is filing an appeal. On what basis? What did you, are you aware of what she is claiming in her appeal? I can't even imagine that.
No, I'm not. Now, in Maryland, you sort of have an automatic right of appeal to the first appeals court. So the fact that she's appealing it is, you know, is not unusual at all. Her appellate attorney has filed, you know, for a few extensions, and so it's late. Her legal brief is due in February of this coming year, and and you know, people around the case don't really know what she will appeal about. You know, they've got some good appellate attorneys. She's now represented by the public defender in Maryland, which, you know, again, is not unusual. You know, her family doesn't come from a lot of money, and they did have a private lawyer for the trial. So, no, you know, we don't know what the appeal will be. You know, is
now,
was
there much forensic evidence? Did they end up discovering her DNA or fingerprints on these weapons that were used to brutalize her victims?
Yeah, there was a lot of there was a lot of forensic evidence. Now. Now, her DNA in the store was not, you know, it was part of the whole package of, you know, they had blood spatter, they had DNA, they had they had blood in Jana's car. But, you know, the DNA in the store, like, you know, for instance, Brittany's DNA on a hammer, you know, can be explained by the fact that everyone
who
worked
there
at that
right.
store used that hammer to build their little displays. So, it, you know, it was what the forensic stuff really did was disprove Brittany's story. You know, that it certainly tied her to the killing and made it very tough for her attorneys. But what it really did was, you know, just blow up what she was trying to say.
How long did the trial, how long did the prosecution take in their case, and how long did the defense take? And did you happen to hear from any of the jurors after they deliberated and found her guilty after that hour as to what was the most compelling piece of evidence for the jurors? Or that's, I guess, a three-part question.
Well, I was about to say all three parts are great. Those are all great questions.
They are.
The trial lasted for a week, and it was all the prosecutors putting on their case. The defense lawyers did not call any witnesses. They didn't call Brittany. You know, they tried
didn't?
To counterpunch. No, they did not. They just tried to counterpunch the whole time with cross examination, and they didn't. They just, you know, they didn't have a whole lot to work with. You know, she had two pretty good attorneys. They didn't have a whole lot to work with, and I talked to three jurors a lot for the book, and they really helped me make the trial interesting, right? Because you know, without the jurors, it just is like reading about, okay, you know, this witness comes in, but, you know, these guys are telling me what they're thinking in the jury box. Yeah, they're doing a good job of sort of clinically looking at all the evidence, but, you know, there's times in the trial where they, you know, it got to them. I mean, this was really emotional stuff. I caught a real, I guess you'd have to say I caught a real break with one of the jurors, because he's a criminal defense attorney who got on the jury. You know, there's a whole there's a whole interesting way that he got on the jury. And he kept a journal at night of, you know, what he was thinking and even what he would have been doing if he was a defense attorney. And, you know, he was able to share the journal with me, and just a real sharp guy. And there's another juror, just to get back to how the jurors, I mean, everyone who was around this case was touched by it emotionally. I mean, even like the medical examiner, you know, they wrote a chapter about her, about, I can get back to that. I can, Tricia, you know, I can talk about this story for about 6 days if you'd like me
and
to.
That's fine, but yeah, I mean,
I'm still interested, and we haven't answered the third question yet, so.
Oh, I've got to answer the third question, or there'll be big trouble. What was it again?
The key witness for the prosecution was the last witness. She was the medical examiner. She was on the stand for 3 hours, and she was very good. It was horrible because there were pictures of Jana's autopsy. But, you know, what she established, you know, with zero uncertainty, was that there were 331 blows. There were probably, you know, there were at least 5 different weapons. And then there was blood tracks in all the wounds, which meant Jana was still alive until the very end. Now, she might have been unconscious. I mean, you know, she may not have been feeling the stuff at the end. But
let's hope.
All that stuff, you know, is horrible and as gross and gruesome as that is, it all speaks to premeditation, you know, because I think you had mentioned earlier that, you know, premeditation can come basically if you don't stop what you're doing. I mean, you know, 331 times she's got a chance to stop, and she doesn't. And that's all, you know, laid out there in detail by this medical examiner. And the different weapons, you know, she's able to describe these weapons, these injuries, and saying, well, okay, that's one weapon. Here's a different weapon. So that means that, you know, this killer is putting down one weapon and picking up another one. That's more premeditation.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, for the jurors, and it took me a while to realize this, you know, it took me a while talking to them before I really, you know, before I got it into my brain of just how hard it was for them to look at those autopsy photographs compared to us in the press, because we're sitting there watching them, and they're showing these autopsy photos, and we can kind of look down, and, you know, we don't have to sit there and stare at them. But these jurors are being asked to study this stuff really closely. And so that was, you know, that was 3 hours that was very emotional to them. You know, going back to it, there's another juror, a guy named Ron Harrington, who's a real smart guy. He's a nuclear engineer. It was a smart jury. There were a lot of, the prosecution did a good job of, he wanted a smart jury, and he got one. You know, the prosecutor put Jana's mother on the witness stand because the prosecutor's a smart guy, and he knew that would have an effect on the jury. And Jana's mom wanted to, you know, she was willing to do anything. She would testify if that would help the case. And when you do DNA, you know, one thing you have to establish is that you don't have a twin. I mean, that's the one thing that can explain, because whereas Jana's DNA played a role in this case as well. And John McCarthy, the prosecutor, knew that Jana's mother, Phyllis, would have, you know, an emotional impact on the jurors.
Right.
And he was right. And so Ron's sitting there watching, And, you know, he's being like a kind of like a clinical engineer through the whole trial. And Phyllis, who I got to know as I was writing the book, just a really neat person, insightful person, she used the word jeepers in the middle of her testimony, which is, you know, she's Phyllis from the Midwest, you know, it's sort of this corny word, right, like, that people don't use anymore. You know, she just said jeepers to a question about, like, how long she had lived in Texas. And so Ron, this juror, is sitting there, and he just has this jolt because, you know, he's thinking there's only one other person in the world that uses the word jeepers, and that's my own mom.
Oh,
And his mind just started going, and he started thinking, well, that could be my mom up there, and she could be going through, you know, what if this had happened to my, you know, a member of my family. And so,
right,
you know, I didn't notice it at the time, but, you know, Ron's crying, you know. He's this big, kind of sturdy
big Texan guy.
Yeah. So
falling like a baby.
You know,
that's just... Keep going. I'm sorry.
Him, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think it would get to everybody. Michael, do you have any questions? We do have to kind of wrap it up here in a little bit, but I want to make sure that we get everything you want answered, because you do ask the greatest questions. We have already established that. So,
well,
what do you have?
Well, she did get life without parole. Am I correct? Without parole, or did she get parole? No. Life without, right?
Correct. Right. Correct. Life without. Yeah,
that's
good.
Right. That's
and
the category in Maryland. Yeah.
Right. And again. Go ahead, Michael.
As you talked about the autopsy photos. Were most of her wounds superficial? Well, I know that they're obvious. Was there a lot? Was it just bruising, a lot of bruising, or did something actually penetrate the skin? Did she bleed out? Was it a really? I'm thinking of all the stab wounds on Travis Alexander. Were any of the implements she was using sharp enough to puncture skin? Did she have lots of like stabbing type injuries, or were they more? Do you know what I'm trying to ask? I'm sorry.
Sure. No, a lot of them were really bad. You know, they were most of them were blunt force with a hammer or with a steel bar that Brittany had, and they were just, you know, there was Jana's head was her skull was cracked in a lot of different places. There was a very bad stab wound to the base of her neck. You know, it wasn't like of the 331 wounds, you know, 300 of them were bruises. I mean, there were a lot that were really bad. You know, and we haven't talked a whole lot about Jana's family, but, you know,
what is her? Give us a rundown. Give us kind of the Reader's Digest version, if you will, of Jana's family, because she seems like such a lovely girl, just like Brittany, and that's what's so shocking.
Right.
But give us a little bit about her family.
Well, you know, I was really impressed with them, and, you know, when they found out that I was interested in writing a book, you know, I talked to Jana's dad, David, over the phone, and, you know, told him I wanted to come down to Texas and spend some time with them. And they were totally on board with me learning everything I could about Jana. I mean, you know, they figured that if I was going to write a book, they wanted to know everything about Jana. And you know, she was very successful and smart. You know, she wasn't perfect. I mean, I think compared to, like, myself, a lot of other people weren't really perfect. But you know, she had her flaws, but for her family, that just made her all the more cherished, you know. And I think they wanted me to know everything about her so that she would be real in the book. You know, what they went through during this case and what they still go through every day is, I mean, it's just profound and it's awful. And, you know, it's, you know, David, Jana's dad, you know, still working. He's you know, getting up there, late 60s as I was writing this. He's still going around the world, you know, drilling oil, working at sites, managing drilling operations. You know, he deals with this every day. You know, obviously, and you just you can't. You can work at it, I guess, but you just can't get out of your mind how your daughter died. You know.
Oh no! Oh
no!
It just every waking moment would be it. Dan, you've written this book. Do you have any future plans of writing anything else, any more true crime in your future that we should know about?
Nothing right now. I'm back at the Post, writing newspaper stories about crime. But I'd certainly like, this is my first book, and I'd certainly like to write another one. So,
How did you find the whole writing a book process, Dan?
Excuse me.
How long did it take you? How long did it take you to write the book, and how did you find the whole process?
It was hard. I mean, as a journalist, I know a lot of people who have written books, and they all warned me that this would be the hardest thing you'd ever do. I agree. it was hard. I took 6 months off from the Post and reported it and wrote it, and then I went back to the Post. But I hadn't quite finished it. There was a little rough period there where my wife and I had our first child, and I was trying to finish work, and then I was back at a newspaper job, which is sort of a lot of work in itself. So, it was kind of a long year in that regard. I just found, I still look at myself as a journalist, just as pure nonfiction journalism, it was just very rewarding to be able to, try to understand a case in great detail. Even the thing about how the detectives were so scared of the story getting out, and seeing the other side of it and seeing how it was very important for them that none of these details got out and how scared they were of leaks and
why? How long did it take for the trial to happen after the murder?
It was pretty quick. It was the murder was in March, and the trial was in the end of October. I mean, it really moved very
quickly.
That was
quick.
Yeah, but
that
was
amazing.
Yeah,
much more quickly than what anyone thought. But the judge wanted to keep it going, and the defense really didn't raise any good reasons of why it should be delayed, so it just it just started right on time.
Well, I want to give everybody the name of the book again. It's called The Yoga Store Murder. It's written by Dan Morse, and if you can go to Amazon and get it, or you can go to websleuth.com, look to your right, scroll down just a little bit, and you will see a rolling Amazon ad, and the book is there. You can just click on it. It does come in Kindle. Basically any form you want. I think for a price, Dan will come to your house and read it, if I'm not mistaken. It's available there.
I will.
Anyway, Dan,
I will read to anybody.
That's right. You're such a good reader. Dan, it has been a delight. Michael, do we have any other questions before we wrap it up tonight? I want to make sure we get everything out here.
Oh, I don't know. I'm sure there's more I would love to know about this case, but no,
it's
I
fascinating.
Can't think of any off the top of my head. But
it's
thank you,
great...
Dan. I echo Tricia's sentiment exactly. You were just a fascinating guest and great to hear from you about this.
Oh, thank you.
I guess
for all
the one
questions.
Question I do have, what was the, during discovery, as we all know, the evidence that the prosecutions and the prosecutors and the detectives have uncovered becomes public knowledge, doesn't it? What was the fear that you spoke about that they had about anything coming out before trial?
It was more in the opening week of the investigation, right after the case broke, because their fear was a story, that says the detectives are actually looking at the victim as a suspect, because that would have really hurt them, because they, from the time they thought that maybe she was involved, they spent 4 or 5 days talking to her, and getting information out of her. And they really played themselves out to be kind of patsies, you know, sort of bumbling guys that, mm-hmm. you know, they were talking to her, you know, they bring her down and say, you know, you're our only witness. You know, we're kind of lost here. And she, you know, they allowed her, you know, she spoke freely to them, you know, and obviously if she would have picked up the Washington Post and said and read a story that they think she did it, then that would have had a direct bearing on their case. So
now, was she a really talented liar? Was she believable? Obviously, she wasn't a Casey Anthony or Jodi Arias that was so skilled in their lies.
I think she was pretty good. I think, you know, what happened was she just had too much forensic stuff to overcome. I mean, she made a very good impression, you know, on the detective she talked to in the hospital. You know, that detective believed her. But she, excuse me, sorry about that. She,
that's okay.
You know, actually, she was such a good liar that she probably thought she could talk her way out of some of these holes that she had created. But, you know, she was up against some pretty smart detectives who she just couldn't wiggle her way out of
these
problems. That, yeah, exactly.
Not enough. Well, Dan Morris, thank you so much again. We really do appreciate it, and I think we've actually talked your throat totally dry now. So go get a drink of water, rest and relax. Let's make a great stocking stuffer, everybody. The Yoga Store Murder, it is by Dan Morris. Put it in your stocking, or your husband's stocking, or wife's stocking, or, hey, a neighbor's stocking. Who knows? It is really, truly worth the money. Get it tonight if you can on Kindle, because you'll want to read it and stay up all night and finish it. Dan Morris, you are a doll. Thank you so much for staying so long with us. We appreciate your time, and I'm sure we'll have you back again soon. And if anything happens that's really interesting, call us up and we'll just have you on the show. We love all kinds of stories that you'll be covering. Okay?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. I'd love to do that. You know, something's always coming. So.
Yes, keep us posted on everything. We want to know the scoop. Thank you, Dan. You take care.
I have one last-minute question for Dan.
Okay, one last
question. Dan, do you only cover local crime for the Washington Post, or do you touch upon big cases that make the news, like McVeigh and McStay family and Arias and Anthony, or is there someone else at the Post who covers those?
Yeah, it's pretty local now. You know, I covered the killing at the Navy Yard, you know, a few months ago. That was a national story, but no,
right.
I'm pretty much doing local stuff. We got a lot of stuff going on that keeps us busy.
Local in the Washington Post is can make national news in a heartbeat. So we want to hear all about it, all the good stuff. Dan, thanks again. You take care now and have a wonderful holiday. Okay.
Okay, thanks a lot for having me on. I enjoyed it.
You bet. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Michael, great question.
That was
tonight.
Wonderful, yeah.
Yes, great question.
I didn't
question.
Care for the first part as much. I know that the chat room seems to really enjoy it, but...
you mean the first, the two ladies?
Yeah, I didn't understand what their premise was.
All they basically were saying was that because the media makes such a big deal out of it, gives it so much attention, yet when you break it down and look at it statistically, they're saying that story shouldn't get that much attention if you're just going by what happened. And what they're taking out of it is the emotion behind it. Because it's such an emotional, school shootings are such an emotional story, you have to add the emotion in when you're talking about how to cover the story. Theirs was about the research they did and how the media played on the story and kind of created this huge thing that where everywhere we turn, it seems like there's a school shooting. And what their research was saying was, that really isn't the case. That was it, basically. I wanted to get more into the mental health issue of it, and we'll try and do that next time. But that was what she was saying. I know you got all. I know you got kind of wound up. You kind of like a jack in the box. All of a sudden, Michael boing comes in.
Well, I do think it's heinous, and I do think it's only in the last couple decades that it's really increased. It seems
it
like
has.
These are happening all the time now.
And that's their point, is when you break it down, it really isn't happening all the time. But, it, you know, every day I think when my son goes to school, I think, you know, please God, don't let there be a shooting, don't let anything happen, let him be okay. And, you know, that's how we all feel. It's just because it's such an emotional issue, we can't not cover it for 30 days because there's so much to know and so much to learn. But I'm telling you, people, we need to get on this mental health thing. If we want to stop this, you know, yeah, it'd be great if we could get the guns out of their hands, but if they don't have the mental problems, if they don't have the mental issues, it doesn't matter if they have a gun or not. They're not going to do it. So that is going to be my theme through all of the rest of my radio career, is we've got to get into the mental health issues when these heinous crimes happen, so we can prevent them from happening again. Michael, you have yourselves a wonderful weekend. Give my love to all of your babies there, and we'll talk to you again next Sunday, okay?
All right. Thank you so much, Trish. Thank you, everyone.
Take care. And don't forget, everybody, Trish's True Crime Radio, are you ready, is brought to you by, hold on 1 second, I need to get to it, here we go. It's brought to you by Paws for Purple Hearts in Palo Alto, California. This is such an amazing organization. Paws for Purple Hearts is the first program of its kind to offer therapeutic intervention for veterans and active duty military personnel by teaching those with post-traumatic stress disorder, teaches them how to train service dogs for their comrades with combat-related injuries. Go to www.pawsforpurplehearts.org. And, you know, we always have to leave you with the goo, the legal goo, that is. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. Do remember, Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from websleuth.com, LLC, and formsforjustice.org. In other words, if your true crime brain just gets all wound up and you're mad, don't take it out on the forums. You come to me, moi, Trisha, and we'll see what we can do about making you happy all over again. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everyone.